Geri buraya.
Because they'll tell us that because Tosh Mapeh is so vast, so huge, and especially in the olden days, it's supposed to be Tosh Mapeh literally, one's not supposed to write it down. So, of course, it's very, very difficult to remember everything. So, therefore, Chazal strongly recommend that a person should make Simanim LaTorah. A person should try to make all kind of different mnemonic devices, all different ways of remembering all the intricacies and the details of Halacha. And that's what we find. Chazal actually did that. And they gave all kind of strange, funny cases to highlight the fact that if you remember some other case, then there's a fighting chance you may remember some of the lack of premises behind it. So obviously when Chazal gave cases, they were talking to their generation, they were talking to the people so they could understand what those cases are. It's very once in a while, Chazal gave a case, and we can't even relate to it. It's a very foreign concept to us. Sometimes we break our teeth over the case, and we forget to look at what the principles behind are. So one of the classic examples of this, Chazal highlighted some very basic halakhic principles by using a very common type of a scenario, is the very first Mishnah in Masechet Shabbos. The Mishnah is trying to highlight all the details in terms of carrying a Shabbos. The Mishnah, rather than just telling us in a very dry, bland way that this is a Rosh Hashanah, this is a private domain, this is a public domain, and if you do an Akira, you pick up something in one place, you put it down in another place, a Chayav, rather than just giving us a list of rules to remember, so Chazal drew us a picture. And it was a picture, it was a very common picture, that you have Nebuch, you have an Ani who's standing outside, and the Ani sticking his hand inside, and the Baal HaBayis is putting something into the hand. Ooh, that's Gevaldik. That could be used to describe, this is a Tzotzor, this is a Chnosa, this is a Akira, this is Anach, we'll define all these things as we go along. And if you remember this Mishnah, so then you remember everything in Hilchos Shabbos. Problem is that most of us, when we learn Masechet Shabbos Tabeis, you get so wrangled, so bogged down in the picture, so confused with who's coming and going, you forget what the Klolim are. So if you spend enough time, then you figure out that the Klolim are really very, very easy if you just understand what the illustration is. So I can just imagine if the Mishnah was being written in Zman HaZeh, what type of illustration Chazal would use. What could we possibly use to really, really highlight some of these basic principles in terms of carrying on Shabbos? Now some of you may be wondering why we even giving Hilchos Shabbos shiur. We're learning Hilchos Shabbos in the mornings, on Sunday mornings. So the answer is that those who are at the shiur this morning is that we're up to the melacha of Dosh, and we have quite a few melachas to go, and it's already taken us 6 months to get to that point. And we haven't even touched Bishul yet, which is a half-year project in and of itself. So at the rate that we're going, sometime around 2026 or so, we'll probably get to the Malacha Motzah. So in case anyone remembers what we say tonight, so remind me in 7 or so years from now. So we're going to talk a little bit tonight about the Malacha Motzah, about the Isser of carrying a Shabbos. But we're going to write the Mishnah as it would be written in Dafshin Ayin Tes. If we want to think something that the Hamon Ha'am can pick up on, the Hamon Ha'am can really relate to, so we're not going to use the Marshal of the Baal HaBayis and the Ani, we're going to use the Marshal of a football game. We're going to use the marshal of running with a ball, passing a ball, kicking a ball, all the different things that sometimes take place in the course of a football game, and try to highlight and see who's doing Akira, who's doing Hanacha, who's doing Havar Zalab, where's Rishas Ayachar, where's Rishas Arabim. So again, just close your eyes and just try to imagine, just in case you haven't seen one in a while, try to imagine a football field, and try to imagine a ball, and try to imagine people running up and down the field, throwing balls, running with balls, kicking balls, and we'll try to see if we can work out some of the details of the very ABCs of Hilchos Shabbos. After we finish that, hopefully it will take us a long time, but as long as it takes us, then we'll try to move a little bit out of the realm of off the football field into the field of life, and try to see perhaps one or two messages. At that point, we may have to turn off the recording, but we'll see where we're up to at that point. So everybody sit back and relax and enjoy the game. Okay, so before we can even begin to discuss the malacha of carrying a Shabbos, we have to just really identify just a few very, very basic principles. Namely, there are three distinct Torah prohibitions of carrying a Shabbos. There is what's carrying from a Rishus HaYochid to a Rishus HaRabim, from a private enclosed area to a public area. That's called Hotzah. Then you have vice versa, what's called Hachnosah, carrying from an outdoors into an indoors. And then you have the third thing, which is called Havaras Dal Amos Rishus HaRabim, carrying within a public area, but you carried more than 4 amos. Any one of the above is an absolute Torah prohibition. The Gemara derives these from a series of psukim and Talmud Moshe Sinai. And the bottom line is, this is Yaduah before some. This is not something to any discussion, any debate. These are the three basic prohibitions of carrying a Shabbos. The Rambam of the Shabbos, when he quotes these dinim, the Rambam writes that this is Yaduah before some. This is known and obvious that Kol Gufi HaTorah Nitnu LaMoshe Rabbeinu B'Sinai, that all the basic rules of Torah were given to Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Rambam writes, and the Pratim of Hotzah, the details of Hilchos Hotzah and carrying a Shabbos were given to Moshe Rabbeinu reading on Har Sinai as well, the details of what's Rishis Hayach, what's Rishis Ram, etc. All of the above is clear, simple, as the Ish B'Pi Ish Ad B'Yishir Aveidu. So within these three prohibitions, so we mentioned very quickly that the term Rishis HaRabim and Rishis HaYochid become very, very important. Now, we're not going to spend the whole time today, we're not going to spend almost any of the time today defining those terms 100%. They're really 105 blah, let's say, with Erevin, and then a couple of Prophet Shabbos dedicated to that. But for our purposes, very, very, very kitzid nimrutz, Rishis HaYochid is an area that is surrounded by walls, like the most Rishonim are surrounded by three walls. Rishis HaRabim is a very, very public area, where which is a rather large area, quite the sub-Rishonim, that's to be very, very large, large enough to hold a very, very large amount of people, more than attends any football games, more than six football games put together, quite the sub-Rishonim, 600,000 people, a lot of people, other Rishonim say you don't need so many people. But again, the basic principle is carrying from one to another, other to the other, or within Darabim, you are asking for trouble. So before we can even begin to discuss the intricacies of carrying on Shabbos as it relates to all the different parts of playing football, we have to identify for ourselves what exactly is a football field. What exactly is the status of a football field? Is it a football field of Rishis HaYochid? Is it a football field of Rishis HaRabim? Is it somewhere in the middle? So it may depend on a few different points. So if a football field is completely exposed, then it's going to depend on different fields. Let's say you go to some, not some major NFL stadium, you go, some school, some high school football field or something, which is not surrounded by any walls, any fences, or anything like that, so then it's not going to be a Rishis HaYochid. So then, if it's not a Rishis HaYochid, if it's not surrounded by walls, then it is potentially a Rishis HaRabim. If it's a Rishis HaRabim, which of the Malachas can we be speaking about? Well, there is no Rishis HaYochid to Rishis HaRabim. So obviously there's no Hotzot taking place. And if there's no Rishis HaYochid around, unless somebody's really bad and they're throwing the ball all the way into the stands or something, so if you keep him on the field, even if you throw it out of bounds, but if you're basically within the open area, so then there is no Hotzot to speak of because there's no transferring from Rishis. There is no Hachnasa to speak of either because there's no Rishis HaYochid present. However, a potential is it would be Havaris Dal Amis Rishis HaRabim. So if you label a football field an open field without any enclosures whatsoever as being a Rishis HaRabim, so then the only Malacha D'Araisa that we could be addressing is Havaris Dal Amis Rishis HaRabim. However, it's quite unlikely that a regular field is going to really be a Rishis HaRabim D'Araisa. Obviously, according to those who say you need 600,000 people, that's clearly going to fall short. Even according to other opinions, there may be other reasons why we're going to believe that fields are probably not a real Rishis HaRabim D'Araisa. But they probably are what we call a Karmelis. A Karmelis means an area that, although it's not quite a Rishis HaRabim D'Araisa, because it's missing one or two of the conditions, but Midirabanan, it's treated as a Rishis HaRabim, and it has all the chumras pretty much of Rishis HaRabim, and you're not allowed to carry down Amas and Karmelis. So your average field, again, a cheapy high school football field with no wall surrounding it, is most probably a Karmelis. And as such, you can't throw Dalet Amos there. And as such, you can't run with a football Dalet Amos there. And as such, you can't kick a football Dalet Amos there. Because any moving and transferring of anything within a Karmelis more than Dalet Amos is a potential prohibition. So we're going to use the terms which is Rabbi Kamos almost interchangeably now, but you all know that we're not talking about the rice, or somebody's getting skila here, we're only talking about the rabbis. But what if the situation is a little bit better? What if the field is enclosed? Let's say you go to a stadium. So you go to a stadium, obviously it's going to be enclosed. You don't want everyone just jumping into the stadium and not paying anything. So obviously it's surrounded by walls, surrounded by gates. So what is that status of the stadium? So that sounds like a great place to be. It sounds like it's a Rishis HaYochid, because it's surrounded on all sides by mechitzas. So in the Chabrishas HaYochid, call them a hill. So that would be great. So that would mean that any carrying, any throwing, any passing, anything that is played in an enclosed stadium would automatically be permissible. Again, I'm not talking about playing ball. You guys know what I'm talking about. I'm not really advocating playing ball on Shabbos. This is nothing here is Lamaisa. This is just an Elmas Al-Yerim. So a person wants to throw a ball in an enclosed stadium, so then we're dealing with the Rishis HaYochid, and presumably that would be great. However, not so great. The Gemara tells us in Masechet Shabbos that if you have a very, very large area, even though it's technically Rishis HaYochid, it's surrounded by walls, if it's an area what's called Lohukof Ladira, if it's an area that's not was not surrounded with walls, for the purpose of actually living there, so that becomes a problem. In the Rabbanon, that's considered to be just not really Rishus HaYochanish anymore. That takes on the status of a Karbalist. So even though it's completely surrounded by walls, but it's too big to be a real bona fide Rishus HaYochid, and therefore, if it's Lo Hukof Ladira, if it wasn't surrounded for the purpose of living in it, then it takes on all the characteristics of a Karbalist. It's interesting because the shear of a Karmelist happens to be the same shear as the Chatzar HaMishkan, just in case anyone's wondering, there's a Pasha's Truma shear also. So, the same shear of 100 by 50 Amos, that happens to be the shear of the Chazal Bekeveya. So if it's too big, that's going to be a problem. So let's do the math. 100 by 50 Amos, who's going to tell me? You know, how much is 100 by 50 Amos? How many feet? We'll go 100 Amos, okay? So 100 Amos, how many feet is that? About, let's say, the biggest shear, the Chazlish shear, 200 feet. How big is a football field?
300 feet.
Too big already, okay? So unless you're playing only at half the field, and you cut off the other half of the field. So any football field, by definition, is going to be a, what we call in halacha, a character. It's going to be a makom shel, which is a yach shel hukuf ladira, and it's going to be a problem. So just because it has walls surrounding it, that in of itself does not solve the problem. Unless one argues that a football field is called hukuf ladira. Why would one consider that to be hukuf ladira? So that's a big machlekes aposkim. What is necessary to create hukuf ladira? So the Chazanish argues that hukuf ladira, dira is defined as living space, like in all other areas of halacha, which means a place that a person either eats or sleeps in. You may remember this from the Chanukah, from the Chusukah, from dira, teishu kein taduru. So a place that's set aside for a person to have the ika mokum dira, eating and sleeping, having their meals and having their, or they're sleeping there. So that's considered to be a mokum dira. Anything short of that is not considered to be a makom dira. So I ask you, is a football field considered to be a makom dira or not? So last we checked that most of the major eating that takes place doesn't even take place at the stadium. Where does it take place? It's in at the tailgating part, right? Okay, the party's outside. So maybe you can argue that the parking lot may be a makom dira. The stadium itself, just because you're buying a little nashes along the way, according to the Chazanish, that falls short, that's not called a makom dira. Unless the person is sleeping there. Because anybody sleeping, if you're paying $1,000 for a ticket to go to Super Bowl, you're probably not sleeping there. Unless you're really left, who buys tickets to soccer games and never learns. But most regular people don't do that. So most people are neither eating or sleeping at the stadium. So that would pose a problem. The problem is, with that box may not be true of the rest of the stadium, because that's most of it's on the pizzas. So the box itself would be okay. The box itself is less than the society anyway. The box would be alright. You want to carry in the stadium, you got to buy a box. Okay, good. So the stadium itself, we're pretty sure, is going to run so far. We don't mean HaTorah, it's not a Rish, it's really Rish HaYochid in HaTorah, but because of this, it's elevated to the status of a Karmelist, and therefore we have a potential problem of carrying in this area. Unless one redefines and waters down the definition of Mukhuf Ladira. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in a tshuva that he thinks the Mukhuf Ladira doesn't have to be such an ayayay kvias, as long as it's basically things that people like to do. Rav Moshe even gives the example when he talks about whether Manhattan is called the Mokam Mukhuf Ladira, when it's famous shuva about the Manhattan Arab. So he speaks about the fact that people sit on the sidewalks in Manhattan and they sit around and he describes people go fishing on the FDR drives and I don't think there are any fish in the river anymore, but the Frida Kedairis, when they used to be fishing or alive in the East River. So Moshe looked out the window, he saw people fishing there. So he described maybe that's considered like a shtickle mukha fadira, so maybe that would be good enough. It's interesting, we had an interesting shayla about a mukha fadira. We had a shayla on our Eruv, whether there was a certain area. Sometimes you have areas in the Eruv that themselves almost create like small pockets of not hukuf ladira. We had a shayla under one of the underpasses of a Route 4 that the way the Eruv had to be maneuvered, we had to create almost like a separate Eruv in that little underpass itself, and we were trying to figure out whether that area was called the Mokum Hukuf Ladira. So we weren't sure whether people actually eat there or not. Baruch Hashem, we found that there was some remnants of drinking that took place, that it wasn't bottles of Coke, that seemed to indicate that there was some very serious dira that was taking place. There were some other things there, there were remnants of other kinds of things that were taking place, and we won't talk about them right now. But the bottom line is that was one side of the hotel, and maybe that's going to Ramosha, that's sort of the shikurim at the bottom of the highway, maybe the ones who saved you to be able to walk over to see the lane on Shabbos, in case you're interested. Okay, anyway, that's just a side, we have to cut that out, that's unofficial area of talk that's not supposed to take place here. Okay, anyway, back to our story. So
Hukuf Ladira gets tricky. So according to the Chazanish, a stadium is probably not Hukuf Ladira. According to the Moshe, maybe you could argue a stadium is Hukuf Ladira. But maybe we can make the stadium a little bit better by putting a top on it. So now I need some Bikias here. Nope. Which stadiums have domes on them? Nope. Nope. Minneapolis has one. Where else? Basically, the rule is if it's very, very hot or very, very cold, it has a dome. That's usually the rule of these things, okay? So in Texas, no? Texas has?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Minneapolis has. Where else has?
Yeah, okay.
So good. So having a closed dome may make things better. Why would having a closed dome make things better? So the Mishnah Berurah quotes a big machlokes about the sugya of karpet, about what if you have an area that's not Mukhaf Ladira, but Mamash has a ceiling on it. So some Rishonim seem to say that has a ceiling on it, that's Eilichom Shisayam Kol Mizeh. You cannot label something as a Shisarabim that has a ceiling. So according to those Mekilim, we can differentiate between different domes. Depends which city you're playing in. So if you're playing in,
New York.
MetLife, you're playing a MetLife, so MetLife doesn't have a dome to it, so that would depend on the Mechagish Revelation that has an ish. But if you're playing in Minneapolis, so then that would, that may be a different story. So then according to some Poskim, that would be labeled as a real Mishasayachim. Why would one think that having a dome changes things? Why would one think having a ceiling changes things? So the Gemara tells us in the Sefer Shabbos that on the level of the Arais, having a ceiling does impact on Rishiyos and Shabbos, because an area cannot be a Rishis Aram Derais if it has a ceiling to it. By definition, in a Torah, if it has a ceiling, that's not going to be the Midbar. The Midbar didn't have a ceiling, it had an Aniyakovah, but it didn't have a ceiling. And therefore, anything with a ceiling is, by definition, Mufka, definition excluded from being a Rishis Aram Derais. This is the reason why, in case anyone's interested, that if you have a choice to carry on Shabbos on the upper level of the bridge or the lower level of the bridge, it's better to carry on the lower level of the bridge. Because the lower level of the bridge cannot be possibly the Arais if it's got the upper level of duck. Or if you're interested in carrying the Lincoln Tunnel, so that would not be a Nisa Deraisa. If you're carrying on the upper level of the bridge or carrying in other places, so that may be a Deraisa. So just in case anyone happens to be stuck on the bridge on Shabbos, so go for the check what it says on the lanes. If it says Deraisa, Derabanan, so you go for the Derabanan rather than the lanes. Okay. Anyway, get back to that story. So we have a few tzadim to say that maybe. The area that we're talking about is not the Rishis Ram Deraisa, that's most probably not, and it's possibly it's not even Rishis Ram Derabanan. But for the purpose of our Shia, we're not so convinced any of this is true. Many stadiums have nothing on top of them, some football fields have nothing around them altogether, and even those that do are very, very questionable what their status is. So we're going to treat everything like Rishis Ram Deraisa, Derabanan, whatever you want to call it, and from here on in, we're going to assume that we have a real problem here in terms of carrying any given stadium. So again, Chazrin back to what we said at first, what carrying do we have a problem with? So we don't have a problem of Hotzah, because we're not going from one Rishis to another. We don't have a problem of Achnasa, because we're not going from one Rishis to another. But we do have a problem that Halacha Moshe Messina Vavarz Da'al Ha'amas Bishis Arabim. I mean, the Bishis Rav, the Arais, and the Rav, whatever you want to call the stadiums, we're going to treat them as subject to the Isra of carrying Da'al Ha'amas. So now let's begin to analyze how much carrying of Da'al Ha'amas actually takes place in any given football game. So I'm going to need some help along the way. I haven't, my days, my recollections, as those that know from Avos Abanim, so I'm still in the period of Joe Namath. My later years, I remember, Fred Tarkenton, those some names that ring a bell, but you tell me who's playing the last 30 years from now, it's I'm clueless. They told me there's a guy named Brady, Les Brady, I checked with the guy in the Brady Bunch. I don't know anything about the Brady's, but that's what they tell me about. That's what my experts tell me. Okay, good. So back to this story. So let's try to work through the game, all right? So we're going to start with a very, very simple play, all right? I need everybody's help here, especially the younger guys. I need some help, all right? We're starting with the first snap, all right? So I know there was a kickoff before. I got all that. We'll talk about kickoffs as a center. But I want to talk about the first snap, all right? So here we have our two positions. So we have our center. That's the guy in the middle, right? That's what he used to be called. He's still called that? But Kishma Kenyu. He's the guy in the middle. He's holding the ball, and he snaps the ball back to the quarterback. Okay, so what exactly happened? So he was holding the ball. So when he hands off the ball to somebody, so he is doing potentially a malacha of something or other, potential malacha of Avarz Da'al Ha'amas Bishus Arabim. The only problem why that's not a problem of Avarz Da'al Ha'amas is why? Because it's most probably not Da'al Ha'amas. It's most probably less than Da'al Ha'amas. So even though we have a rule, Chatz Yashir is also, you're not allowed to do half malachas, but this is one of the exceptions to the rule that you're allowed to carry less than Da'al Ha'amas. Even in Rosh Hashanah Deraisa, you're allowed to carry less than Da'al Ha'amas. What you're not allowed to do is carry less than Da'al Ha'amas, stop, and then start again and keep on walking for the whole 100 yards. That you're not allowed to do. But if you just do it one shot, so just a quick snap back to the quarterback, that in of itself is less than Da'al Ha'amas, and that is not a Deraisa, it's not even a Nisa Derabon. So that's pretty good. Unless the snap is taking place in the following sense. What if you have have the following. What if you have shotgun position? Okay? So now you have your center, and now, thanks to who? Who's the who instituted shotgun? Even I know that. Who started shotgun? Who's the first one to use a shotgun?
Dave.
Roger Staubach, okay? The Dallas Cowboys, 1970. But he's the one who made it. He was the Chadish to say they have a shotgun. So, am I right? Right? I got the keys, right? Okay, good. So, the guys, if you ask me who played on the offensive line, that I can't tell you. That I don't remember anymore. So the center snapped it back, and the quarterback is back. I'm not aware of the details of football, so the quarterback is now a couple of feet back. So now it becomes very, very doctristic. Just how far back is he? So this may depend on what you think the shield of the Al-Ramis is. If you don't like the Chazanish, the Al-Ramis is very, very big. So then I don't know how far. I never tested how far the snap is for a shot. Anyone have any idea? I would imagine it's less than 8 feet. I would imagine it's significantly less than 8 feet. I was probably close to about 2 feet or so. So probably it's talking to the Al-Ramis according to all opinions. So again, I've never measured it. So we're going to assume for now that snap is less than the Al-Ramis. If that snap is less than the Al-Ramis, so then the center is potter. The guy who's chopped the ball back is going to be potter. Okay, so now the quarterback's got the ball. So he's the next guy in charge. We're trying to figure out what potential halacha deraisa derabban he's about to violate. So let's think clearly. The Mishnah tells us in the Sefer Shabbos and the Beis that in order to violate carrying Min HaTorah, you have to have two things present to be a real bona fide halacha. You have to have akira and hanocha. You have to pick the item up, and then you have to place the item down. That's what the Mishnah describes, the famous Mishnah about the onion and the balabayas. So if I pick up something in Rosh Hashanah Yochin, I walk into Rosh Hashanah and put it down, or vice versa. Or if I do it all within Rosh Hashanah and I walk more than the Al-Ramis, so if I did the akira, I picked the item up, and I did the hanocha, that's considered to be a malacha. So the chora, it would appear that halacha of requiring an akira to get the malacha to start already is going to interfere with the quarterback violating any issue. Why? Because the quarterback didn't really do an akira, because the akira of the chayfetz was done by the center. The quarterback was the recipient of that ball. So he's standing over here, and the ball's thrown to him, or handed to him, whatever the play is. He has the ball, so now where's the akira sadavar? So the answer is there is no akira sachayfetz, but there is what's called an akira saguf. And the Gemara says, the first bechum is a Shabbos, that akira saguf ki akira sachayfetz gummy. So let's say, for example, somebody tosses the ball to me, I catch the ball, and I start to walk with the ball. So the minute that I start to walk, that's called an akira, and when I stop walking, or I place the ball down somewhere, that's called a hanocha. So if I do an akira and hanocha together, that's the malach of carrying on Shabbos. So l'chora, the quarterback's akira is not what we call an akira sechefetz. The brisket tell you, it's not an akira sechefetz, it's an akira sechavra, akira sa'odam. The akira sa'odam is considered to be an akira sechefetz as well. So the quarterback is now holding the ball and he starts to walk backwards. Okay? So let's say, for example, he's about to try to throw a pass. Okay? On the first down, he's going to try to throw a ball. Okay? So he's trying to throw a pass on first down. So he's backing up a little bit into the backfield. So he is very possibly going to go more than the Al-Ramis. So by going more than the Al-Ramis, he may have just done an Akira, and they have also just done a Hanocha, if he stops along the way, not the fence. If he stops, starts, then he didn't do an Akira Hanocha. But if he just keeps on running, and finally he's back in position to throw, so when he stops to throw the ball, so he just violated Hanocha. So he did an Akira a couple of feet before, maybe more than the Al-Ramis. He does Hanocha back there, and we have a problem. We just nailed him with an Akira and Hanocha. So I was thinking about this a little bit today, and I was wondering, you know what? Maybe I can come up with something even more creative. Maybe what was violated over here was not just the malacha of the Al-Ramis, but there may have actually been a malacha of Hachnasa that was violated as well. Hachnasa, where's the Rishis HaYochid? So we started off by saying there's no Rishis HaYochid anywhere near this. I mean, Midrabban and the whole thing is Rishis Ram, where's the Rishis HaYochid? So the answer is that maybe Rishis HaYochid here based on a sugya that appears in the fourth verse of Erevin. The Gemara tells us in the fourth verse of Erevin that there's what's called the Mechitza Shavnei Adam. You can have an area which is surrounded by a lot of people, and there's no walls here, but if you have one small area, there are a lot of people around you, so the people themselves may actually serve halachically as a Mechitza. The Gemara says the Chatchila on Shabbos, you're not supposed to rely on this to carry, but Midaraisa, that's called the Bechisa. So now the question is, just how good is the offensive line? So if the offensive line is really holding back the linebackers who are trying to charge and, you know, and sack the quarterback, if they're really holding them back in a good place, and the quarterback is pretty much exposed, so then the good luck is that he has not entered into Rishus HaYoch, then he's only subject to the Klal of Rishus HaRav, Dal Amos Rishus HaRav, which may or may not be reached this year. But if he is surrounded by a group of linebackers and the whole defensive line that's about to kill him, and he's also surrounded at the same time by his chevra on the offensive line, who are trying to get rid of the big guys who are trying to sack him. So what may happen here, and again, I'm trying to go back in my mind to those images of many, many years ago, but that image of a quarterback almost surrounded, literally on all sides, he's surrounded by people. So what may have been created here was a mechitza, a status of mechitza shel b'nei adam, which in Ucha Shabbos is going to pose a problem, because he just carried from Rishus HaRabim into a Rishus HaYochid. Now in case somebody is thinking that, well, he's not completely surrounded, there are breaks, not a complete circle around it, there are breaks, so it's going to get very, very tricky, because the Mishnah says at the end of the first Bech of Erevin, that you determine mechitzas based on Amud Ruvel HaParos. So if you have any given area that has more wall than breaches, halachically that's considered to be a wall. So again, try to envision this, not that anyone's going to see any picture of this in the near future, but in case anyone wants to just use this picture, and a person is surrounded by a lot of people on all sides of him, is he surrounded by Amud Ruvel HaParos or not? So it could be that he is. And if he is, then he just violated the Malachat Yerayis of carrying from Rishus HaRabim into a Rishus HaYochid. It gets very, very Erevin, it's getting beyond the scope right now. It gets very tricky if one of some of the pirtzas are on the corners, and one of some of the pirtzas are more than 10 amas, that's really beyond the scope, maybe next year. But it's just food for thought whether or not the quarterback backing up and to throw that pass, whether he just violated a potential malacha of Havara or potential malacha of Achnasa. So he's about to throw the pass. Okay, so he's ready. How close? No, as long as the area is own Ruvel HaParos, it doesn't matter. As long as the area is more than four tefach by four tefach. You mean he may be have, oh, interesting idea. But the people in the stadium, he may have to throw out because the stadium is too big. Because
the whole team. Sidelines,
parents and the end zones, that you have to think about. Nothing here should be taken off of my. These are just things that when I've been stuck in traffic the last couple of days, I'm just kind of think this through. It's a good opportunity to chazam a second Shabbos here. Okay, good. So anyway, back to the story. So the fellow's backing up. He's about to throw that pass. All right. So he throws the pass, and now what happens? So when he throws the pass, so if we think about it, he just did it at Kira, and now the question is, where is the hanocha? So this is actually a Gemara. The Gemara first Pesach Shabbos talks about, if I throw something and somebody else catches it, whose hanocha was it? Was it my hanocha? Or was it the other fellow's hanocha? So the Gemara says it depends. So if the recipient of that ball, that pass, is just standing there, the guy's spazzering, he's standing in the end zone, and he's standing here like, you know, kickball game, you know, just sitting there waiting for someone to throw the ball at him. So then that's Nikra Al-Shay in the original Zorek. So the Zorek did the Akira, and the Zorek did the hanocha, and the Zorek is potentially fire. But more likely what's going to happen, the Gemara describes, is that the person who's the recipient of the ball is going to jump towards the ball. He's going to go up. He's got another guy. He's got the guy in the defensive guy in the back there. He's following him step by step in the pass. He's jumping up for the pass, so he's actively contributing to try to get that pass out of the air. So the Gemara says that's called a hanocha mitam de mekabel, not mitam de zerik. And therefore, it turns out that the quarterback was an oikir without being a meniach, and the wide receiver was a meniach without being an oikir. So that's exactly what the Mishnah says in Shabbos. Neither of them is chayef, because each one of them did a half malacha. The din is, you have to do malacha shleim in order to be chayef. So in case you're interested in a way to play football that won't be a nisadiraisa, just make sure that you jump up to get that pass. If you participate in getting the pass, so then that would not be a malacha gemura, but the raisa, neither for the zerek nor for the bekabel. That's a gemara mamish right, or they'll go about wide receivers, but that's a gemara right out of the first parak of Masechta Shabbos. Okay, so far we spoke a little bit about throwing your passes, but we know that football is made up of a lot of different plays, so there's rushing as well. So how does rushing fit into this picture? So rushing gets a little bit trickier, because rushing is not an issue of Zayrik, rushing is Ramesh Metaltel. So now, let's think it through. When the quarterback hands off the ball, so he backs up for a minute, hands off to the The guy behind him. So the guy behind him comes and grabs onto the ball. So what happened exactly? Did the quarterback stick it into his hand or did he take it from the quarterback? Usually, I think the quarterback hands it to him. So the quarterback handed it to him. So then the quarterback did the Akiras HaChefetz and the running back didn't do anything. Unless the running back does what? Unless he stops. If he stops, so then he does a new Akiras HaGavra. Now, as he's maneuvering, so first he runs this way, then he sees the guy's about to tackle him, so he turns around, he goes the other way, another guy's going again. Every time he stops, so then the clock stops and starts over again. So if he's successful in getting down Amos from one place to another without stopping in the middle, then the running back violated the Malacha. How much is down Amos? He said, about somewhere between 7 or 8 feet or so. So that's not such a great... what is that? How many?
2 yards.
Yeah, that's schwach. You don't want to be 7 and 8. I mean, that's not the best place to be. So maybe the 3rd and 1, maybe, okay, get the 2 yards, you'd say that. So it gets tricky whether the running back is actually going to really violate any Malacha D'Oraisa or not. So that you have to figure out case by case. So now that we figured out, we spoke a little about the passing game, a little about the rushing game, so there's another important part of football, and that is the kicking game. So where exactly does that place us in terms of the potential of
others? What about when the wide receiver catches the ball and then starts running?
So if he jumped up to get it, so he did the, that's called him doing the Akira. So now he does it, and now he starts running, so then he does the Nacha when he reaches the end zone. And he throws it down, he does his dance, and then he does the Yetzah. And the Mishnah is not allowed to dance on Yom Tov HaShabbos. Okay. So again, so now we're back to the kicking. So kicking is a very, very complicated thing in Halacha in terms of football, because at risk of art, there are different kickings, there are different guys. I always found it fascinating that a guy can spend his entire life, fascinating enough, a guy can spend his entire life playing football. That's like Halbitzar. But a guy can spend his entire life only doing one thing. He's a punter. That's all he does. He doesn't know how to do it. For all practical purposes, he doesn't even know how to hold the ball. I mean, he's got to hold the ball a little bit in case once in a while he has to run with it. But all he has to do is know how to kick. That's all he has to know how to do. It's an amazing thing. Guy spends an entire lifetime just working on it. It was last week, so I was away for a couple of days. So I took my younger daughter to the state fair or something down in Florida. So there was a show. Who was? Oh, you guys knew this, right? So there was a show there, the Pogo Sticks, right? So, right, you know, the Pogo Sticks, so they showed a guy. The guy spent the last 40 years of his life jumping up and down a Pogo Stick. And he told you that. All I've been doing since I was 5 years old was just practicing to jump up and down a Pogo Stick. I don't know, there was like some kind of a disconnect there. I couldn't exactly figure out, like, I understand a guy does a lot of funny things, a guy spends a lot of time doing a lot of things in life, I understand, you know, you want to be a punter, you want to be a baseball player, you want to be a pogo stick guy, I understand you want to be a mole, the same thing, it's such a gavalik and musa, spend the whole life in one place, the whole life. But anyway, so you have this one guy, so he's about to punt the ball, so the fellow's about to punt the ball, so wait a second, is kicking a ball considered to be a malach or not? Is that considered to be carrying or not? So on the one hand, he's not carrying with his hands, so maybe that's not called carrying. Maybe that's called kliyach hayad. So the answer is, well, it depends. If you would kick something which is not normally kicked, let's say, for example, something on the floor, and instead of picking up, so I kick it, so that's a malacha kliyach hayad. The Mishnah says that would only be potter. That would not be derais. That would be nisid derabon. But there's no absolute rule that kicking is kliyach hayad. If it's something that's dark of a kach to be kicked, so then that would be malacha d'oraisa. That would be ketakim b'kach. Let's say, for example, the Mishnah says if you carry something in your mouth, so that's not called malacha d'oraisa in Shabbos. But the Gemara says that what if you carry food in your mouth? What if you carry chewing gum, chewing something on a candy in the street? So that is called carrying. So it's not a cloud gadol that your mouth is not called a malacha. If your mouth is an app, if you carry a sefer in your mouth, if you carry something else in your mouth, that's not malacha d'oraisa. If you carry something that's dark, but if you carry in your mouth, that would be a d'oraisa. So the same is true with kicking. If I kick a dollar bill or something, that's the derabbanan. But if I kick a football, so you're supposed to do it a football. So that's considered to be a potential malacha d'oraisa. So when the punter punts the ball, is that really malacha d'oraisa or not? So I was thinking that maybe not. Why is that? Well, who's going to tell me, based on the shiurim this morning, who's going to tell me why punting is probably not malacha d'oraisa? I think it's a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. Because the Mishnah says that any time you do a malacha to remove something from you, I don't want to use the item. I want to get the item as far away, literally as far away as I can from me. So the Mishnah says, if you carry out a dead body on Shabbos, that's the Malacha Shetzich Lagufa, Machlekes Tanoim, Machlekes Rama, the other Rishonim. When you punt the ball, you don't want to use that ball. It's not like the guy was carrying it. When I throw a ball, when the quarterback's passing the ball, he wants the ball to get to the receiver's hands. He wants to get closer to the end zone. When the running back is running the ball, he wants to move the ball in that direction. Over here, I want the ball to get as far away as possible from me. I want to see this ball. I'm not such a great punter, so the best I can come was a 40-yard punt. But if I could, I'd like to punt a 95-yard punt. So the further away and get it away from me, that's the Hasir Sadov and Olav, and many of the Rishayim say that's called the Malach Yetzir, Lagufa. So that's a Machlekes the Rambam and the other Rishayim. So according to the Rambam, that would still be a Deraisa. According to the Rambam, we can't punt on Shabbos either, it's a Deraisa. But according to most Rishayim, there would only be a Nisim in the Rabbanim. So it's not clear in the Shulchan Aruch. There seem to be steers in Shulchan Aruch, Avi Paskin and Mishailah. So most of the later Paskin say, we assume it's only the Rabbanim. So we can hide behind Malach Yetzir, Lagufa, at least for the punter. But what about other kinds of kicking? So let's say, for example, the field goal kicker. So the field goal kicker, so for him, that's not a Malach Shetzir Lagufa. He wants to get the ball exactly where it's going to go to. He wants the ball to get into the, over the Shvichikul. He wants to get it into the end zone. So if that's the case, that's a Malach Shetzir Lagufa. Is there any way we could save the guy who's kicking the field goal, kicking the extra point, is there any way to save him that he's not violating their Isa? So I think possibly for the following reason, that this is a tricky shayla of Shabbos. I do an Akira, and I can say I throw something, so I did the Akira, I throw it, and I'm very, very happy with what's happening, and I'm fully and completely satisfied with the results, and as far as I'm concerned, the item that I threw could self-destruct once it accomplished my results. I'm not particularly interested in it landing on the ground. I don't really care whether it has a hanocha or not. But l'mais, l'fi derech ha-teva, that's where it's going to go. It's not going to go up in space. Gravity, Isaac Newton's flood capacity, it's going to come down to the ground, so it's going to hit the ground. I don't really care that it hits the ground. As long as it made its motion in space, it did what it had to do, Shalom Yisrael. Is that called the Malacha Deraisa or not? So that is a Machlekes Rishonim. Some of you may remember, we spoke about this last year in the Shavuot Shiur. Machlekes Tosfos, Tosfos Rosh, in the Sefer Bechor Bava Kamma, about a ganav who tosses an animal over a fence, whether that's called Malacha Deraisa. Leave out the details right now. Bottom line is, that's exactly what kicking a field goal, an extra point is. That L'fi Azdaiti, I think the rule is, that once it goes through the crossbars, it doesn't have to land. Does anybody care where it lands? Nafkamina? Not the slightest, no, you care less. If that ball would self-destruct and blow up into smithereens, you would still be yotzei, you would still get all the points that you have to get. So, you don't really need a hanocha. Now, there's going to be a hanocha, but you can care less about that hanocha. So there is some Hashem, there's a place in Russian book that says, that's called lack of malachas machshavas. Malachas machshavas means that I want the entire complete result of malacha from A to Z, from beginning to end. Here, I don't really want the hanocha. There's a lach pati about the hanocha. And therefore, that wouldn't be a Malacha Deraisa. So according to that, I said, Rashi Levakamah would come out that even the field goal, the extra point, would not be a potential Malacha Deraisa. What about, so far we covered the punter, we covered the field goal, we covered the extra point. Who else do we need? What do we need? Opening, we need the kickoff, right? We need the guy, the placing, the guy that kicks to start the game off. So is that a Malacha Deraisa or not? So I think that that's much closer to the punter. I mean, the goal is to get that ball as far away as possible. I don't want to use that ball. Forget, I want to get that ball away from me. I want to go as far as possible on the kick, so they have the worst field position. So the stubborn, that would also be a potential Malach Shetzich Laguf. So I think we've covered entirely the offensive team over here. So as we all know, football games are not won by the offense. They're usually won by the defense. So we have to give them at least a little bit of time to understand a little what potential Malachas could the defense be violating. I'm not talking about the intercept or pick up fumbles and that kind of stuff. I'm talking about just tackling themselves. So if the big guys who are trying to tackle the other big guys, what's the din? Is that called any potential malacha or not? So if you think about it, when I tackle somebody, so I am creating a hanocha, that I am stopping the person. The same way we said that hanochas gavra is considered to be a hanocha, so if I stop a guy dead in his tracks, you can theoretically tackle somebody without actually knocking him down to the ground. If I'm not mistaken, if you stop all forward motion, so that is considered halakha. I think that from a little fairly gavarious, that is halakhically the same as the back. So the minute that I have officially stopped all forward motion, I have done a hanocha, and I have now done a hanocha. Now the truth is I didn't do an akira, so a deraisa it's not going to be, but a hanocha without an akira is still in the siddur rabbanan. So here we run into an interesting potential application. It's called shnayim shasa'uha. The Mishnah tells us that if two people do a malacha together, so that's not a malacha deraisa. So what would the din be if two guys tackle together? That's usually what happens. Very rarely one guy. It's usually six guys. Six big guys. Knock down one big guy. So is that called shnayim shasa'uha? Nah. So one could argue that that is not called Shnayim Shesa'ua for the following reason. That the Mishnah tells us that if you have a situation where it's a very, very heavy object, and one person can't do it on their own, and the two people join together, that's not called Shnayim Shesa'ua. Then they're both going to be chayav. What's the reason for that distinction? So there are different opinions in the Rishonim. So some suggest the reason is because that's Darka B'Kach. Whatever is Darka B'Kach is a Malacha D'Raya. You say whatever is not Darka B'Kach is not. So tackling is Darka B'Kach. That's the name of the game. That's what we do. Your job is a linebacker. And your job is a defensive end. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to gang up together when the one guy knock him down to the ground. So that's Darka B'Kach. So that's what you're getting paid. I can't even begin to mention what the numbers are to do that. That's what your entire parnasa is to make sure the guy does a hanachas aguf. He stops dead in his tracks. Hopefully not dead literally. So that's the next issue about Ritzicha and watching football. So maybe you could argue that both anyone who participates in the tackle is not called a Shnayim Shesa'ua. That's considered to be each one is hired independently, because that's considered to be the Derech HaKach of the Malachim. So as you can really begin to see that there are some very, very real ways of visualizing some of the basic principles, some of the ABCs of carrying Shabbos. We spoke a little bit about the Rishios in Shabbos, we spoke a little bit about Akiris and Hanachas, a little bit about Hanachas Agufas and Akiris Agufas, and Havar Zahar Abbas Vishisarabim, and Loch Shetzich Agufas, and Shnayim Shesa'ua. So we gave a little bit of a smattering of some very basic Yesedis of Shabbos that can, if you just use your imagination enough, you can see that much of this is actually played out literally on the field. Since it is almost Rosh Chodesh Adar, so I guess we can say it's a little bit of Shnichas Adar Arba Simcha. We get a little bit of a fun, a little bit of a joy, and just get hopefully a kicks out of some of the things that wasn't a planned fun, some of the things that we saw. But again, I don't care whether anyone remembers anything about the football game, but if you remember the Klolim out of Shabbos and every once in a while people will remember some of the Klolim, because they'll remember, oh yeah, Rav Zelowski gave a crazy shiur one night 20 years ago about Roger Staubach's shotgun. Maybe that's a shot of a Dalav, which is a Rabbim. So there's a fighting chance. Somebody may remember what I spoke about. But whether or not you remember the first half of the shiur, I hope everyone does remember it, but I hope everyone remembers the next couple of moments of the shiur as well. And we have to leave the football field and enter into the field, or whatever you want to call it, of life. And I thought we'd just give a little bit of the b'chiv, this iris, and again, almost invoking some of the mishalom that we're under the yoyim, that we give it too much chashivas, but you understand what I mean. There are different games that are played, different ball games that are played, and some of them have the clock as a major component, and some of them don't. And fundamentally, in American sports, the game that doesn't really have a clock is baseball. That's why baseball is very relaxing. That's why, it's the yeshivish game, because you can sit back and, no one's rushing anywhere. And, you can play, if you keep on hitting, the game just can never end. In some little leagues, it's not the field that way. It's never going to end. So when it's 37 to 36 or something, then they call it because everyone's just bored and tired and want to go home. But baseball, in a sense, never really ends. Whereas other games, so there's something that, in a sense, artificially, that is superimposed on the game, that puts an end to it. At the end of the day, the game is going to end. The football game is going to end. It's true, there's a limit. How many times can you run out of bounds? Even if you run out of bounds 1,000 times, and even if you keep on dropping the ball, at the end of the day, so the clock is going to tick down, and the game is, in a sense, going to be over. That's true. Basketball, you have that. Hockey, you have that. So that superimposing of the clock in football is critical. And anyone who knows anything about the basic football strategy, it impacts on the game to a tremendous extent. It means the things that a person does at the beginning of the game are radically different than what happens at the end of the game. And you see it, I'm sure, all the time. You see it very, very often in the early parts of the game. In my days, Taka, they used to rush much more than they used to pass. They used to be a much more of a rushing game. Over the years, it's become much more of a passing game for a very, very simple reason. I don't know why. It's more exciting, that's why. It's nothing to do with the art of the game, which just simply has to do with more exciting. Very often there are developments in sports that have nothing to do with the game per se. They're just managed to attract fans. That's why the American League instituted it as a designated hitter. That's why they changed the texture of the baseball. Everything, it just makes things just move a little faster. So in today's world, people are not interested in watching rushing plays to get to second and eight and third and two. And that's not, the guy wants to see that first bomb that's thrown. I don't want to use the name for the bomb because that would be a shot of mention of a bizarre, but you know what I mean. The guy, they want to see that first 40-yard pass. They want to see that quick screen pass and the guy run down the sideline for 50 yards. That's what people want to see today. But in the beginning of the game, you don't see as much of that. Usually, again, things that, you know, different teams have different strategies, but at least in my days, I remember that in the early part of the game, you tended to see much more of a running game than a passing game. Because the reason was people had time. When you're starting off, it's the end of the fourth quarter, so you don't want to take, you know, when you pair, the minute that that ball leaves the hands of the quarterback, you are looking at an interception. The possibility, there's always a risk of an interception. So you want to play a much more conservative game. It's like the person that invested money, very conservative, he's got it. I'm not going to even begin to try to tell you anything about that, because I know nothing about football. At least I used to know something about the stock market, I still don't know nothing about. But you know, the guy's very, very conservative. Play the beginning parts of the game very slowly. You run a quick, you know, run a drop play, tackle. You run in the very simple, you know, simple, easy, 3, 4, 5 yards. You know, you get yourself into a 3-1 or something. You know, those are the good, that's the old style way of playing. Then, you know what, if you had a bad first down, then you throw the ball a little bit, you try to get a little bit of, pick up a little yards, try to get a first down. As the game gets later into it, so then people start to get desperate. Now again, depends which team you're on, depends whether you're winning or losing. If you're winning the game, so then you start caring, then you stay on the ground as much as you want. Because as long as you stay on the ground, that clock keeps on ticking away. The minute that ball leaves your hand, so then you're talking a potential incomplete pass, incomplete pass is going to stop the clock. That's the last thing you want to do if you're winning the game. But if you're losing the game, so then you got to move, and you got to move quickly, and you don't have time. You're down by like 20 points, and you're at the end of the third quarter. You don't have time to run some exotic 3-yard rush or something. You got to pick up 10 yards, 15 yards, 20 yards, 30 yards. You got to move, momentum, get that ball going as fast as possible, because you got to get it back. After you kick it away, you got to get it back in the field position. You got to start over again. So you got to move. You have to move the ball. So as the clock becomes more and more of a factor in the game, so the tempo of the game and the very strategy, the very essence of the game begins to change. So that model, I think, is a very, very profound model in terms of life. That we have to ask ourselves a fundamental question in life. What quarter are we in? That's the real question you have to ask yourself. You're the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, or fourth quarter, or overtime. Depends on how old you feel you are. So, as we get closer and closer, it's time to feel more and more. So what is our strategy? What is our life strategy? How are we viewing our existence in Olam Hazeh? We're viewing ourselves that we have plenty of time. We got all the time in the world. We can take our time, run a couple of, you know, runs. A big deal. If we don't make the first down, we'll punt it away and, you know, pick it up again 2-3 minutes later. Do we have that luxury of time? Or our back's against the wall and we're down by 3 touchdowns and we better get some quick touchdown, get a really, really quick, you know, a quick kick in there, get the ball back and then start running, moving again. We don't have time to play around with having halfback running circles and wasting up the, eating up the clock and getting us a total of 3.5 yards. We got to really, really move the ball. So where are we in life? And the answer to that question is a very, very profound answer that we don't know. That this is where life in football begins to part ways. Football, we know exactly how much time is left. Whether we like it or not, there are 6 minutes left in the third quarter. That just, I don't know, right now, that is the reality of the world. You look at the scoreboard, you see exactly what time is left. In life, we don't have that luxury. Kadosh Baruch Hu does not give us that knowledge. And therefore, we have to play the game of life in almost multiple different ways. We have to play the game of life as if it's the first quarter, as if we have a lot of time, and we have to play the game of life as if there's 1 minute left, and we have to score 2 quick touchdowns and cut right a field goal in the next 60 seconds. We have to play both of these things. And what do we mean by playing both of these things? At the end of a game, so the teams tend to get careless. The team that's behind starts to get careless. That's why sometimes you have these games that they're only down by 14, but then all of a sudden, by the time the game's over, they're down by 28. Why? Because they got careless. They threw a crazy pass. They did some sugar to play. And they ended up getting interception. And all of a sudden, the game becomes lopsided. Very, very common when you start to take risks. Like in the stock market, take risks. So risks sometimes pay off. And sometimes you flop on your head. So when you start throwing these long, long bombs, so you're always risking the interceptions and you're risking it working against you. So it becomes very, very tricky. So in life, we don't want to become sloppy. In our Avodas Hashem, we don't want to become sloppy in our learning. We don't want to become sloppy in our Midas. We don't want to become, you know, doing these just crazy things that sometimes you see. A person will decide, I'm going to sit and learn now for the next 16 hours, and I'm going to sit and learn every single night till 4 in the morning, and I'm going to get up at 5 in the morning, and I'm going to sleep, and I'm going to eat, and then because it's, you know, what am I going to do? You know, life's ticking away, the clock's ticking away, and I got to get every last second, I got to finish Kol Tarkum in the next 10 minutes. So sometimes people get like that, and they don't realize that. But it's only the first quarter. You're going to burn yourself out. You're going to end up that you're not going to have any offense, any kochos to finish the game. Life is not a 100-yard dash. Life is a marathon. You need kochos, and Yevedis Hashem needs kochos as well. On the other hand, a lot of people, probably more people, in the second category. Yeshiva Bachur tend to be in the first category, but everyone else tends to be in the second category of, I got all the time in the world. The game just started. I'm young, I'm vibrant, you know, it's only 3 minutes into the game. Why am I speaking about triple overtime at this point? Because, as the Rabbi writes in the Cheshuva, nobody knows. Nobody knows. That's the middle of the mysteries of life. Nobody knows where, what, who. It's not here to scare anybody. That's just the reality. We all know that. Nobody wants to talk about it, but of course we all know that's true. Nobody knows. And therefore, so we have to play the game as if every second counts. There's no time for wasting time. There's no time for derailing on the clock. There's no time to run down the clock. We don't have the luxury of life to run away the clock. We don't. The clock is ticking against us. It's not ticking in our favor. There is an end in sight. And that 2-minute warning is going to come. And Kadosh Baruch Hu is not even going to give us the warning. The warning is going to be in Shemayim. We're not going to hear the whistle down here. And then the game is going to be over. And at that point, you either won or you lost. And, you know, in the Super Bowl, at least you have a chance to come back next year. In the game of life, there is no next year. Maybe next Gilgul, that already is beyond the scope. Maybe next year, sure. But the bottom line is that there is no next year. There is no next game. You either win it or you lose it. And we have to walk a tightrope in terms of life, in terms of decisions that we make in our ruchnius, that on the one hand, we have to live our ruchnius with care and careful and make sure that we don't burn ourselves out. We have to play it like it's the fresh beginning, like it's the beginning of the game. On the other end, we have to also have that desperation that, wait a second, it's maybe the last toss, it's maybe the last pass I have. And therefore, it better be a good one. And every single moment, that's what the Rambam is posting in Chazal, every moment, Shemin Arosh Al Yechsa, first has to view themselves as is, Mia Demaye Lejoy. That was a depressing part of tonight's shiur. We'll try to get a little bit back into a little bit of a cheerier note. So what are some other important lessons we could learn in terms of Hashav and Hashkof, in terms of just Hadracha in life, in terms of what happens in the field? So I think there are a few other important lessons. Chazal tell us in Masechet Brachos that when a person comes to deal with the Emes, there's a voice that comes out that says, Ashrei Mishabola Kanda Tamuda Biyadai. Happy is the person who comes to this world and is learning, his Torah is in his hands, Tamuda Biyadai. So the Farshim already bothered. What does that mean? Tamud of the other? It's a very strange phrase. They should say, Asher Mishabolakan, the woman Harbi Torah, Asher Mishabolakan, the Rebbe six times. Asher Mishabolakan, Tamud of the Tamud of the other. The Masha writes, that means you have to write down your Chiddush Torah. That's Tamud of the other. That's a Chiddush. Okay, we're not going to go down that roof now. Not everyone has to publish one. But Asher Mishabolakan, Tamud of the other, I think what the Chazal is referring to is as follows, that Rashi writes in Parshas Vayishlach that when Yaakov sent all the gifts to Esau, so he sent animals and all kind of stuff, and he sent Minababi Yadu. So Rashi writes, what's Minababi Yadu? The jewels, the diamonds. Minababi Yadu are the things that are most precious that you don't carry in your pockets, you hold them in your hands, because you hold on to it for dear life. You have something very, very expensive, you're not going to put it on a wagon, you're not going to put it away, you're going to hold on to it, mamish, like your life depends on it. Asher Mishabolakan, the good of the other means, if a person treats Torah and mitzvahs and Kedusha, and mitzvahs and Kedusha is so important, it's the most precious commodity he has, it's worth everything, he will not treat it just lackadaisically, he's not going to treat it, you know, lazy, and oh yeah, great, so I went to an Anshia, what are you doing, and I'll nice, and they went, I gave a little stuff, yeah, great, wonderful, yeah, no, that's great, and no, wonderful, I mean, what else I can do is jump on cocoa sticks for the rest of my life. No, Asher Mishabolakan, the good of the other means, that Torah and mitzvahs is so critical and so important that you're maxing it, you're holding on to it. Life depends on it. You want to know, you want to watch, you want to get a good sense of what it means to hold on to something that your life depends on it. Look at a guy holding a football. Look at the guy running in the end of the Super Bowl. His team's down by six, and he knows that if he makes that touchdown, he's got the ball now, he's got 20 yards ahead of him, and there are 10 seconds left on the clock. If he makes it, the team wins the Super Bowl. And if he doesn't make it, that he becomes the GOAT for the rest of the season. All the jokes are going to be made about him. And the absolute worst, there is nothing more profoundly wrong with what's going to happen right now, that he's holding the ball, and every single person on that defense has one goal right now. Forget about tackling. What do they want to do to this guy? Fumble. They want to knock that ball loose. If you knock the ball loose, that is the best possible outcome you can have in a football game for the person who didn't fumble it, for the other team, for the defense. And the guy who fumbles the ball at the moment of truth can't get bigger goat than that. It's true not just in football, it's true in baseball. We'll give a little Mikias in there also. Who dropped the third strike? Mickey Owen, Nathan Flores, come on. Hey, where were you?
He only knows football.
Only knows football. Okay, you have to be well-versed. You can't just slip yourself the poker stick. So I don't know a lot about everything. Okay, so the fellow, okay, we'll bring it down. We'll bring it back to 1986. No, 1986. No. Buck, Joe, Sean, Billy Buck. So he, remember, most of you guys weren't even born then. You were little babies then. And every kid in America knows about him. Why? Because the ball went right through his legs. Even when you drop something, he didn't even get the ball to hold on. The guy who fumbles the ball on the one line, the 1 yard line, so he's going to be remembered forever. That's what it means. Asher Mishabal coming to Buddha Biyodah. Are you holding on to Torah like your life depends on it? Are you holding on to Mitzvah? Are you holding on to Vedas Hashem like your life depends on it? Or are you letting anything and everybody just knock it loose? Are you letting that big right tackle just knock it loose of you? Are you letting that defensive end just give you a zetz on the side of your arm and just let it go free? All the koiches, all those tackles, all that big, those big guys who are trying to knock the Torah out of you. And all those big guys have names, not just names on the team. They have names. This Yetzirah, that Yetzirah, this Yetzirah. They're all coming to try to wrench the Torah away from you. And you're holding on for dear life. And you're making forward motion. Because the minute that you stop, then I'll be din, you're tackled. You're done. It's your history. The game's over. You lost it. You blew it. If you're moving forward, in the B'nai Hashem, if you're moving forward, holding on to that ball for dear life, then and only then, guess what? Even if the clock ends, if I'm not mistaken, what happens? They still play? That play still goes. If you can keep on moving, even though your time came already, and in Shemayim it's nigzed and it's all over, they give you till the end of the play. So if you're still moving, you can still score that winning touchdown. Rabbi say, there's one thing that is the absolute worst thing you do, perhaps worse than a fumble. This is the nightmare of all nightmares. He could be the greatest quarterback. His name could be you name it, Terry Bradshaw from Tarkenton, some other guys, who do we know? Brady, okay, good. Anyone, everybody in between. He could be the greatest quarterback in the world. But at the end of the day, in the Super Bowl, when his team is depending on him, and they're down by less than one touchdown, and he throws that bomb, and he throws the what? He throws the interception. No, but the Rambam describes in Chashuva that a person does great, great mitzvahs, and then at the end they go off the deep end. No one's going to remember that he had an unbelievable season. No one's going to remember all the good plays that he had. They're going to remember that one interception. Interception is the worst of the worst. Why is an interception so profound? What is so wrong with interception? We all know why. Why it's profound? Because not only did you lose the ball, but very often interceptions result in the other way around. Because 9 out of 10 times, I don't know what the real statistics are, but the guys are playing the offense. They're not just good tacklers. So now all of a sudden, it's benafichu. The defense became the offense. The offense became the defense. And the guys are playing offense. They don't know how to tackle. So the guy who just scored, he just picked up the ball, and he's running 80 yards, and he scores an easy touchdown. That's the worst thing you could possibly do, to have the ball go in the opposite direction. Moshul ma'ad v'doma, and we'll end the bechizik, we'll end the shiur with this. Moshul ma'ad v'doma. I heard this marshal from Osben Schlitter. It was not any bullshit. He gave heard this marshal from him on a Rosh Hashanah night many years ago when he was a bachar. Mr. David tells Telsi Shiva in the Rhein. And I can't tell of the entire marshal because it was also in Yiddish, so only the parts that I remember, so I'll try to the parts that I understood. But the basic marshal went along the following. That the marshal of the Bedoyme, there was a person on a boat. In the old days, either on a boat or on a train, depending on which time in history it was, he was on a boat. And the person's going on a boat, gets on the boat, he asks the people on the boat, which direction is this boat going on? So they say, it's going east, it's going to the east. But I'm going to Mizrach, I'm leaving Mizrach, I'm going to the east. So he gets on the boat, he thinks it's going to the east. I always have the fear when I get on a plane, I don't know, there's like this like phobia of I'm always on, potentially going to be on the wrong flight. Now, it can't happen, Bismarck, we know, they went through all our tickets and everything, but I always listen with a half an ear, that just when they announce, this flight is going to, and always JetBlue always makes jokes or something, they like to say, we're going to Honolulu or something, even though we're going back to New York, just kidding. So the passengers like me, all nervous. So this fellow gets on the boat, and everyone on the boat told him he's going to the east, and then the boat sets sail, and all of a sudden he realizes the boat's going the wrong direction. He sees the sun, he turns on his phone, and he realizes that the The other 10 guys in the boat, each one's compass shows a different direction. I never understood that. The 10 guys at Mincha, and everyone's smartphone's pointed in a different direction. It's a pelagodol. But he's going to the west, and he thinks he's going to the east. So the guy's a real chacham. What does he do? So he runs all the way to the end of the boat. So he's standing, hugging onto the end of the boat, and the boat's going the wrong direction. So somebody says to him, Pliny, what are you doing? What are you holding? What are you halfway off the boat for? He says, well, I have to go to the east. So this way, at least I'm as east as I can possibly get. So the person says to me, Shaykh, you're not going east. The boat's going to the west. So they ain't going to help you one iota that you're going to be hanging on to the edge. You're 10 feet more to the east. The boat's going the opposite direction. My husband said, the Marshal of the Vedeva, that sometimes in Avedis Hashem, so we're going the wrong direction. And we set sail down to the wrong flight. So we're going the wrong way. So we sometimes delude ourselves and thinking, well, it's okay. We're going the wrong direction, but at least we're kind of like, we're doing a little something. We're doing a little okay. But plenty of your boat's going in the wrong direction. The worst thing that could happen in life is that you wake up at the end when the whistle finally blows and you realize, can you imagine the following phenomena? You scored a Gewaldige touchdown in the wrong end zone. I mean, you threw an interception. That went Gewaldigem, the best quarterback in the world. I threw a ball and ended up in the end zone. You shite him, in the wrong end zone. That's an interception. Interception means that, a goal was scored, right? But for the wrong team. And you're the one who facilitated the scoring of that goal. The Baruch Hu looks at us, maybe ask some Shana, and he asks us that question. Are you going in the right direction? Are you playing the right game? Are you going in the right end zone? So Rabbi said, a lot of things to think about. This day of the year, a lot of things. It was a little bit of a lighter year this year than last year. Last year people thought it was too heavy. This year people probably thought it was too light. Between the two, we got the Shulazov. But some important things to think about. That's an important thing. There's some very, very real questions, hard questions we have to ask ourselves. We have to ask ourselves about priorities. We have to ask ourselves about things that are chashuv in our lives. We have to ask ourselves, what messages are we sending to our children? What are the things that really matter to us? Is it really, really matters? Is it really, really so important that our entire life revolves around something as foolish and trivial and silly as some of the things that are taking up, hundreds of millions of people's attention as we speak? Is it really, really important? Is it really something that we should be focusing our life on? That's a hard question to ask. It's important to answer that question for ourselves and for our children. Make sure we're on the right boat. We know that the whistle's going to blow. Sometimes the whistle's going to blow. We hope later rather than sooner, but the whistle's going to blow. When the whistle blows and the game is over, the question is it Asher Mishavolka to put the other? Are we holding on to that football? Have we scored the goals? Have we accomplished what we have to accomplish? So if we've met our goals, Chituk and Mashmo, so then we've had a successful day and a successful lifetime. So the Rosh should give us the Siyata Dishmaya to win the game and to win the big, big game. And this is the big game. What they call the big game is not the big game. The big game is the big game. Okay, well, that might have been it.